Case number 12-3037 et al. Henry Andre P. Williams, petitioner. Ms. Theodore for the petitioner, Mr. Perez for the respondent.
Ms. Theodore.
Good morning, Elizabeth Theodore for petitioner Andre Williams. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, we're here on a very limited inquiry, whether Mr. Williams has made an initial prima facie showing that his Graham and his Miller motions contain new rules that are retroactive and that were previously unavailable to him. He has, and so this court should grant the motions and permit him to make his arguments about Graham and Miller to the district court. I'll start with the Graham motion. The government has conceded the three elements of 2255H that grants a new rule that's retroactive and previously unavailable. So other than timeliness, the government's only argument is that Mr. Williams doesn't truly rely on Graham because Graham itself didn't involve a straddling conspiracy. But as the Third Circuit held in Pendleton, that's a merits question. At most, all we need to show at this stage is that there's a plausible or non-frivolous argument that Graham's rule could apply to the facts here. That's just the standard the Fifth Circuit applied in the analogous case of In re Sparks, where the question was whether the crime of aiding and abetting a burglary that resulted in death was not a homicide crime or a homicide crime within the meaning of Graham. And the government argued that it was a homicide crime, and the Fifth Circuit said that because there was a non-frivolous question as to whether it was a homicide crime, the case went to the merits. Similarly, the question here is whether a straddling conspiracy is a juvenile crime or an adult crime within the meaning of Graham, and so that question should go to the merits. And it's clear that we've made a non-frivolous or prima facie case on that question. The Fourth Circuit in the Evans case, which is just like this case, agreed that the question could go to the merits. And in the Brazel case, which is the case we submitted our 28J letter about, the government itself agreed that a petitioner who was involved in the straddling conspiracies was entitled to relief on the basis of Graham under Section 2255H. In addition, this Court's precedents on the Federal Juvenile Delinquency Act support our position. It's the same question there, which is whether a straddling conspiracy is a juvenile crime or an adult crime. And this Court has held very explicitly that a straddling conspiracy is a juvenile crime unless the government proves ratification after the defendant is an adult.
Is your position that your first position, that we don't have to look at anything, all we have to do is look at the question of whether they've cited a case that that you're relying on, and that turns out to be a new rule of constitutional law?
We don't think that mere citation is enough. So if someone had committed a crime at the age of 50, then we don't think that they should get to the merits. That would be a frivolous argument. So our position is the reliance argument has to be non-frivolous.
So with respect to the way the Fifth Circuit and one other circuit treated Atkins, for example, if it were clear on the face that the person did not have a mental disability, then they would not be able to rely.
Yeah, you know, I suppose, and I think Atkins is a different context, and as you know, there's a split even on that question. The Tenth Circuit in the Ochoa case said in Atkins that no showing was needed. And it's pretty clear the Fifth Circuit wouldn't apply that Atkins rule in this case because we have the Sparks case also out of the Fifth Circuit where they don't. But, you know, the Atkins cases, I think, are aimed at a different question, which is, you know, anybody who's on death row, you know, simply by saying I'm mentally retarded could get to the district court. And here we don't really have that problem because age is something that really can just be determined, you know, on the basis of things like the indictment and that sort of thing.
But it is undisputed that the conspiracy for which he was convicted extended beyond his 18th birthday, right?
That's true, Your Honor, but it's our position.
The time alleged in the indictment of which he was found guilty, how long after his 18th birthday?
I believe it lasted until he was 21, Your Honor. Yes. But, you know, our argument is that in light of this Court's precedents in the same context in the Federal Juvenile Delinquency Act, you know, there's a reasonable argument that notwithstanding that, unless the government proves some kind of adult ratification, that it's a juvenile crime under Graham.
Could you address whether your petition is timely in relation to the Graham ruling?
Certainly, Your Honor. You know, our position, first of all, is that the Court shouldn't address timeliness. We think the text of the statute is pretty clear on that because 2244b3c says that the court at this stage only considers the requirements in subsection B and timeliness is in D.
There's an official filing date with reference to this petition. The clerk's office gives a date of filing. And that date is more than a year after the announcement decision in Graham, is it not?
That's true, Your Honor. But, you know, under the plain text of the prison mailbox rule, Rule 25, you know, Mr. Williams has filed a sworn affidavit that complies with the requirements of that rule. And, you know, the government appears to concede that.
I did not understand them to concede
it. I think the government does concede that the affidavit that Mr. Williams filed complies with the text. So I think the government's only argument is that because Mr. Williams hasn't shown diligence, that he hasn't made up.
The government doesn't concede that he filed as he applies for asylum.
That's correct. The government
doesn't really concede anything, right?
The government concedes that the affidavit complies with the requirements in Rule 25. The government does not concede that the filing was timely, of course.
Conceded as to form does not really concede a great deal, Johnson.
So, but the government's argument is that Mr. Williams has to show diligence, and there's no requirement in Rule 25.
I don't understand them to say he has to show diligence. What my understanding is that the date on the clerk's record is a prima facie case of the date of filing. And it would then be up to him to try to counter evidence. I may be reading too much in to provide counter evidence as to an earlier filing, and that where you do not have any evidence of diligence during the intervening 1.25 years, that he has not overcome the prima facie case of the filing date.
Well, I don't understand that to be the government's argument, because, you know, I think Rule 25 says that a prisoner's filing is deemed filed, is filed as of the date the prisoner deposits it.
Sure.
at the prison.
It's rather hard to believe that he filed it, mailbox filed it, and then waited way over a year and did nothing, and then nothing happened.
Well, Your Honor, he contests, you know, the question whether or not he did nothing, and so we think that's a question we'd want to get to at the district court if this court were to hold that some kind of diligence requirement was
in. It's not a diligence requirement. It's a question of evidence of filing. And his evidence is an affidavit, which is inconsistent with his future conduct. That's not, nobody's saying he has to be diligent, but they are saying that there isn't enough evidence for mailbox compliance.
Well, Your Honor, you know, I think the purpose of the mailbox rule, and this is what Houston v. Lack says, is that the burden shouldn't be on the prisoner to explain why there was a delay in when a filing reached the court. I mean, that's what Houston says. And so, you know, I don't think that the mere fact that there was a delay can really be any sort of rebuttal evidence. Certainly it wouldn't be rebuttal evidence at this stage, where at most all we have to do is make out a prima facie case, and where, you know, it's our position we don't have to show anything on timeliness.
Can I ask you for a clarification on your timeliness argument? Is your argument that the statute bars us from taking into account timeliness, or is your argument that the statute would permit it, but we don't need to, and we shouldn't? We should let the district court handle it on remand.
Our argument is that the best reading of the statute is that the timeliness question is for the district court, not for this court, and that's based on the subsection issue and also on the fact that, you know, a statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, and Mr. Williams wouldn't have to say anything about that to win in the district court. And so it's a little odd at this stage to require him to make a prima facie showing about something that he has no burden at all on in the district court, you know, unless the government comes forward, obviously. So our argument is that the best reading of the statute is that you don't need to address that question in this case, because we've clearly made out a prima facie case based on the sworn affidavit that satisfies the prison mailbox rule.
But as I read the statute, it says that the Court of Appeals may authorize only if it determines, but that doesn't say that the Court of Appeals, once it determines, then has to authorize.
That's right? True, so, Your Honor, but in a situation where where the statute sort of, you know, has a limit, a timeliness requirement, and it's in a section that is not one of the sections that the statute says the Court of Appeals should consider at this stage, probably the best reading is that it should be given to the district court. Also, for another reason, which is that, you know, a petitioner might have an equitable tolling argument or something like that they want to make to the district court and that they wouldn't know they would have to make at this stage.
Can I take you back to the non-timeliness question, to
sure.
the merits question, so to speak, for a second, which is that it seems to me that the statute speaks in terms of relies and contains, and there must be some limitation on the extent to which you can rely on a rule that the Supreme Court has announced and has made retroactive to cases on collateral review. And so you threw out the example of 50 years old, and you said, well, that would be frivolous, and therefore
yes.
that falls outside the bounds. But suppose it's 19, and the person just makes the argument that, look, Graham says what it says about youthful offenders. I'm basically a youthful offender because I'm 19, or I'm 18 in a day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 18 in a day, and I ought to get the benefit of the Graham rule. I understand that it's not within the four corners of Graham, but it's really, really close. And so why don't you apply Graham to me? I'm on collateral review. I'm seeking the benefit of that rule on collateral review. Now, to be clear, let's assume the person is not saying, I get to have a new rule announced in my case. What he's saying is, I get the benefit of the new rule that's already been made retroactive to my case. Would you say that that person could proceed?
Yeah, you know, it's a harder question. I think potentially, you know, and I think one thing that's important to note here is the government seems to want to argue that we have to show that, you know, Graham clearly establishes that we're entitled to relief, but that's not the question in 2255. That's the question in 2254. So, you know, as I say, it's a harder question. I think, you know, a court might be able to say that, you know, Graham's only about juvenile crime, and if you have no argument that your crime was actually a juvenile crime, then you can't proceed. But argument certainly is not frivolous in light of Brazel and Evans and the Federal Juvenile Delinquency Act.
I don't want you to put you in a position where you have to argue against yourself, but in the 18 years in one day example, mm-hmm. What would be the hook for saying that you can't bring that claim? Is it the words rely or contained in the statute, or what is it that keeps that claim out?
I think it would probably be the words rely or contain, yes.
Okay.
Yes, and if I could just get to the Miller motion for a moment, because that's a separate motion that the court should also grant. So our argument there is that, you know, Miller establishes a different new rule than Graham.
I've got a question about that. What is the new rule established in Miller that you say is applicable to your case?
So Miller, for the first time...
Tell me one sentence what that is.
That the line of individualized sentencing cases that used to only apply in the death penalty context now apply in the juvenile context. So that's a new move that Miller makes that Graham explicitly doesn't make.
I thought the thrust of Miller was that the 18-year-old provision against certain sentences for the 18-year-old extended to homicidal cases as well as to non-homicidal. Is that not the thrust of Miller?
Well, that's part of what Miller says, but it also says that what it's doing that's new is extending the individualized sentencing cases to the juvenile context for the first time. That's something that Graham discusses, and Graham says, no, we're not going to do that. And so our argument is that even if the court or the district court below, if this court grants both motions, found that a straddling conspiracy isn't a juvenile crime for purposes of Graham, you know, in a case like this where the life sentence depended on juvenile conduct, that Miller would at least entitle Mr. Williams to consideration of youth as a mitigating factor before he was sentenced to life, you know, as a factual matter on the basis of his juvenile conduct, the drug quantities.
You said something that I may have misheard. You said earlier when we were talking about what rely means, you said that's a question under 2254, not under 2255. What did you mean by that? Or have I misunderstood that?
I wasn't talking about the word rely in that context. Uh-huh. I was saying that the government seems to require us to show that Graham or Miller clearly establishes our right to relief.
Oh, I see.
But that's not the question here. That was my point. Okay. If I could reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Of course. Hear from the government.
Mr. Chief Judge, and may you please the court, James Perez on behalf of the United States. The court should deny petitioner's request for authorization to file successive 2255 motions because he has not shown a prima facie case that he is entitled to relief under Graham or Miller.
Can we start with the timeliness question? I think I understood your brief the way opposing counsel did rather than the way Judge Sentelle did, and I want to be clear about what your meaning is with respect to the mailbox rules. I read your brief on page 26. You say that courts have recognized that prisoners' affidavits need not accompany their original pleadings. So,
correct.
And you don't dispute that the affidavit he filed was sufficient to establish inmate filing under the mailbox rule. Is that
that's,
right?
That's not our dispute on appeal.
You don't dispute that?
We do not dispute
right.
that.
What instead you say is, in the next paragraph, even if the affidavit means he delivered it, his grand petition on May 2nd, it should not excuse his lack of diligence.
That's
right?
correct, Your Honor.
So your argument is that he has to show diligence as part of the mailbox rule. Is that the argument, or what?
Our argument is that the mailbox rule permits him to file his affidavit after he actually files his paper, here the paper being the petition. Diligence comes in when granted, the Mel Barros rule does not talk about diligence, but we refer to Judge Kaczynski's decision in, I believe it's Weezer, in the Ninth Circuit. A petitioner would get the benefit of diligence so long as he, after a reasonable amount of time, he doesn't hear anything back from the court.
Well,
he exercises his right.
I read you too charitably then that you are saying he's required to show diligence in order to get the benefit of the mailbox?
No, Your Honor. I think that after a reasonable amount of time, he has not heard anything back from the circuit in this particular case. Then he is, at that point, required to show diligence. That's the way Judge Kaczynski read the rule, because it only makes sense.
We're not famous for following the Ninth Circuit.
I'm apologizing.
We're not famous for following the Ninth Circuit.
Granted, I think the argument makes sense.
It does seem inconsistent with Judge Kaczynski's usual rule that we follow the text and not what makes sense.
Right.
So in this case, you agree there's nothing in the text, and under the text, timely filing may be shown by the declaration. And your view is that the declaration is in compliance. So that sounds like a prima facie case of timeliness.
Whether or not
it could be defeated by including the judge not believing and thinking that the inmate has perjured himself is a different matter.
Sure.
But I don't understand how this can't be prima facie when the statute says timely filing may be shown by a declaration in compliance, and you think this is a declaration in compliance.
Yes, Your Honor. I think couple points. One is Rule 25, A2C, was not enacted as a habeas rule. Although the courts have recognized it in the habeas context, I think it's important to realize that it's not a habeas rule. And when we put it in a habeas context, when we enact it in a habeas context, we have to think about the habeas.
Well, let me ask you two questions about that. One, I don't remember reading anywhere in your brief that this rule is not a habeas rule. Did you make that argument?
That Rule 25 is not a habeas rule?
Yeah. Did you make that argument before?
No, I mean, no, Your Honor. But it is a
rule about inmate filing, right?
Right, but it's a federal rule, appellate procedural rule. It's not a particularized habeas rule.
It's not particular for habeas, but
correct.
It's for anything that an inmate has to file in the Court of Appeals.
Correct.
And the inmate has to file this in the Court of Appeals.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I'm not following.
My only point is that it would be absurd to not read a diligence requirement in the habeas context. When in the habeas context, which is all about finality, which is all about statute of limitations.
So you're not a textualist. Is that what you're telling me?
I think it would be absurd to not read something into it.
And that was the next point that I was going to make.
That's not the arguments are usually phrased.
Right, and we do cite to a case. In the footnote, which we refer to Weezer, in which this court has said many times that we should not read statutes in an absurd way. And essentially, the government's
that
argument
doesn't
is.
Say that it becomes absurd to not read something into the statute that isn't there. That's two different propositions.
Right. Your Honor, I think it would be absurd in the habeas context to allow a defendant. Or excuse me, here in this particular case, a petitioner to file something on one particular date to get into the 1 year statute of limitations requirement and to sit on his hands for more than a year and do not file his affidavit that's required under Rule 25 A2C.
This is an unfair question that's never stopped me in the past.
And
you do work for the Department of Justice. Why don't all the prisons have mail policies that would create a record for mailbox policy?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question.
I wish somebody up the chain for you to take that up with the Bureau of Prison. You're all in the Department of Justice.
Indeed, Your Honor. Although I think that even if the prison that Mr. Williams is located had a prison mailbox system, I don't think that would necessarily resolve the issue in this particular case, because the question is after
the... But if it said he put it in there at that time... He put it in the prison mail system, dropped it in the mailbox at that time. It would solve it, wouldn't it?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor, because the question here is...
He still wouldn't apply the law by its terms?
No, I think the question...
It would be absurd to apply the law by its terms.
I think the question here is whether or not after, even if we, and for the purposes of these proceedings, we could see that he, according to his affidavit, that he put it in the mailbox on May 2nd, 2008. 2011, as he says. The question is, does the prison mailbox rule or any other rule allows him to sit on his hands for more than a year?
Do you know any other timeliness rule, any statute of limitations, any filing rule that has an implied rule of diligence in it? If you file your lawsuit within the 3 years allowed for a D.C. personal injury case, I think it's 3 years, and the clerk's office there loses it, and it stays lost for 3 years, and you haven't done anything, you think it goes away?
I'm not that familiar with the civil contract.
Do you know of any other contract?
I do not.
Other than the diligence requirement on top of the time limit?
No, Your Honor. Other than Judge Kaczynski's opinion opposing a diligence requirement.
So, if an assistant U.S. attorney files a responsive brief by putting it in the mailbox that we have, the after-hours mailbox in this court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court, because we have a lot of cases, doesn't do anything.
Yes, Your Honor.
For a year.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the assistant U.S. attorney doesn't ask because the assistant U.S. attorney thinks that might raise the ire of the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
We would conclude the assistant U.S. attorney has not filed a response, and therefore the appellant convicted prisoner goes free. That's the position of the United States?
No, Your Honor. I think, again, because, I think our argument is contained and constrained by the habeas context, by the 2255 H2 context, in which this court only has 30 days after filing. If we assume that filing, and Rule 25 tells us to assume that filing is once the prisoner hands it over to prison officials, then this court technically has 30 days from that particular point. This court will, if we follow the strict language of Rule 25A2C in a habeas context, this court will routinely miss that 30-day time frame that's required by 2255.
That sounds like we should have more latitude about timeliness, not less.
This court has not determined that. While 2244B3D 30-day time rule is not a mandatory rule, it's advisory, I haven't found any cases in which the court or this court or any other court has said that this court can violate or go well beyond 30 days, a year, why not 2 years and why not 3 years, because the prisoner decided to sit on his hands.
Can I ask you about the Miller case and about also the inquiry that we were having with your opposing counsel? Do you agree that the Miller case is not based only on the Graham strand of cases, but also on the mandatory imposition of sentencing cases? It's a separate strand.
I understood opposing counsel's argument to be that Miller took into context Graham as well as individualized sentencing cases.
Right, and you agree with that?
I agree with that, yes.
No, then Miller takes Miller, into case.
Yes, Miller.
It relies on two different strands of
precedent. We do agree with that, although that's not the, I don't think that's
the. You agree that it adds something new to this factual
set? It does not, because at the end of the day, Graham gives petitioner the rule that he wants, which is anyone, categorically anyone under the age of 18 years old, well, mandatory
it,
or not.
Does it hurt to have two? I mean, if they were to lose that claim, but if a court were to think that the mandatory nature is what really matters here, and what is particularly bad here, they would have the Miller claim.
No, I don't. I do think it hurts to have two, and because 2255 H2 allows you to have a successive petition, not if another court builds on a new rule.
Well, the Supreme Court hasn't built on the new rule. The Supreme Court itself said, as you just acknowledged, that there are two separate strands, and it relied on both. Now, if Miller had said, well, we're just relying on Graham, I think you would be clearly correct. But you agreed with me that Miller didn't say that, right?
Right. And the only additional thing that Miller adds is for homicide defendants, which defendant.
No, I was going to say the same. I thought you would just acknowledge that it also.
That's what I thought you acknowledged.
And then I was also going to say the mandatory aspect of the sentencing regime. Right. But that's what Graham already. With respect to non-homicide defendants, Graham has already made that rule, and that's the new
Graham
rule.
Graham wasn't about the mandatory imposition of the rule. It wasn't about mandatory imposition. It was about life without parole, not mandatory life without parole, just life without parole.
I think that feeds into our point, which is it applies categorically from mandatory and non-mandatory, and then it distinguishes between the two.
Suppose the Supreme Court decided not to stick with Graham any longer, and they jettison the Graham rule, the Miller rule remains standing. And it seems to me then that Williams would have a claim based on Miller because it remains good as to mandatoriness, even if Graham is no longer good law.
I think at that particular point we would have timeliness issues whether or not they filed within 1 year or not.
Well, no,
that's this particular point.
I don't think there would be timeliness issues, and at least you can construct a hypothetical, which I think is this case actually, in which there wouldn't be timeliness issues. But it seems like Miller then remains freestanding as a basis for relief because the claim would be not that I fit within Graham because I'm juvenile and it's a non-homicide offense. It's that I fit within Miller because it was mandatory. And I don't care what Graham says. All I care about is that it was mandatory, and therefore I get the benefit of the Miller rule.
I have not come across a case with that such a hypothetical. Our only point, however, is that the exact rule that he wants, Petitioner Williams wants, was created in Graham. Non-mandatory, mandatory, categorically, everyone under the age of 18 cannot be sentenced to life without parole. I agree with Your Honor. It does not matter whether or not it was mandatory or non-mandatory in Graham. And in Miller, it took into account the more individualized sentencing factors. But I think another point that would distinguish this case from Miller is that the individualized sentencing that the Supreme Court took into account in Miller, Mr. Williams is not asking this court to take an individualized sentencing context.
Why do you say that?
That's just not his argument. I don't read his argument in the briefs to be that way. Rather, what he says is, I was a juvenile, and therefore, because Graham says that juveniles are less culpable than adults, then I should get the benefit of that rule.
You don't think that on remand, given we're only here for the prima facie determination, they could argue that, look, we're not saying that everybody who started as a juvenile gets the coverage here, but this guy only went until he was 21 at the most, and that is a different case than somebody who went from 18 to 59 as part of the same conspiracy, or that this is a different case from somebody who committed overt acts after he was 18. Or any of a number of individualized considerations. You don't think they could make that argument?
They could make that argument, but that's not the argument that they're making, and that's not the argument that that's not the new rule.
We don't know yet what argument they're going to be making.
That's not the new rule that in Graham that Supreme Court has decided.
It's a new rule in Miller. That's you just told me that the point about Miller was that there had to be individualized determinations, not mandatory determinations.
Right.
And I'm describing.
I thought you said that wasn't new in Miller, that was there already under Graham.
I'm sorry, I think I'm starting to confuse the court. But my only point is that the individualized sentencing in Miller came into context when the court looked at cases that dealt with homicide. And what the court said is that when you deal in a homicide case, that you cannot have especially for building on Roper, you cannot have a mandatory death penalty. And if the court, I see my time is off, if I may finish.
Well, we're still asking you questions.
The court.
Spotswood Robinson used to say those lights only control the bar. Only God can control the bench.
Yes, Your Honor.
You seem to say that the petitioner is correct that there is a second strain in Miller that has to do with individualized sentencing and not just with the homicide.
Okay.
Did I misunderstand?
I think I'm, and perhaps I'm mis explaining myself. I'm not explaining myself well. The way I read Miller is that the court came to the holding that it came to by looking at two strands, mm-hmm. not having essentially two different holdings. The one strand was Graham, which dealt with juveniles and their culpability, their mindset culpability. And then the second strand dealt with individualized sentencing context, and that dealt with, for example, mandatory death penalty cases.
If there is an individualized sentencing strand in that, then is that a new rule announced in that case?
Right. Absolutely not, because the court was that individual sentencing strand which was a premise to its ultimate conclusion, was already established in other cases. For example, in Atkins, which dealt with, Roper, which dealt with juveniles and death penalty cases. That's where the individualized sentencing strand comes from. So to the extent that Mr. Williams is relying on that individualized sentencing strand, that's not a new rule because the Supreme Court cited multiple cases that already talked about it.
Backing up for one more moment to Graham, if timeliness is not a reason for denying the PFA, the motion here, then what is the government's one sentence reason as to why we should hold with the government on the Graham?
Graham is a categorical rule. Graham does not apply to straddling conspiracies. Mr. Williams.
Well, is it determined that it does not apply to straddling conspiracies? He doesn't have to establish that he's going to win in order to get the PFA.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Only that there's an issue that should be passed upon by the district court.
Correct, Your Honor.
So how does saying it's not a categorical rule get you there when there's not a controlling authority?
Because I think the face of 2244 and 2255H2 is very plain that you have to rely on or your petition has to contain a new rule, not an extension of a new rule, not a proposed extension of a new rule, but the
new rule. An ambiguity in a new rule?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because you either, especially in
that,
the context.
Doesn't that make this into a merits hearing rather than a PFA hearing?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The reason being is because this court could look at Graham and decide whether or not Graham actually holds what petitioner says it holds. It does not. The court would do the same thing that a district court would do.
Well, the petitioner isn't saying that Graham holds anything other than what it holds. The question is how it would apply to his case. And when you have a brief here, it has a lot of cases in it, right? And in the brief, you have a section, cases principally relied on. At least you're supposed to have that section, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And no one thinks that every one of the cases that you've listed as principally relied on by itself decides the case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? And here we're using the same word. The court uses the statute uses the same word. It uses the words rely on. It doesn't say rely on and completely resolve the case. It just says rely on.
That cannot be the rule because that would essentially make successive 2255s, which are extremely rare, which are extraordinary remedies, effectively a direct appeal.
Well, that's not right. That's not right because we're not deciding that. You can make this argument to the district court if you'd like. All we're doing is being the first of two gatekeepers.
Right.
It's not true that this would make every case go through. It only means that in this kind of case, the district court gets to decide the final issues rather than we.
My actual point was one step removed from that, which is if all you have to show is that you're arguing for an extension of a new rule, this court will routinely, when it comes to Graham cases, grant those cases and it actually flood, I think, the district courts. So, for example, I have heard petitioner's counsel say that she agrees that someone that's 50 years old cannot get a successive petition or authorization to file a successive petition based on Graham, because Graham does not address 50-year-olds. It addresses no matter, even if the petitioner, let's say you have a 50-year-old who says that even though chronologically he's 50 years old, his mindset.
You don't think there are, you know the word colorable in the sense of jurisdiction, colorable claim of jurisdiction? If a claim of subject matter jurisdiction isn't, you know, if somebody makes a claim of subject matter jurisdiction, this case arises under this statute, but it turns out it's obvious on its face that it's not, we say it's not colorable and there's no jurisdiction.
Correct.
The 50-year-old one strikes me as something that's a not colorable claim.
Right.
Nobody would say that with a straight face, and no one would accept it with a straight face, and that would be the end of it. So I don't think that using that as an example really gets you where you need to be here. I'm still stuck on this asterisk, which I found in your brief, which says authorities upon which we chiefly rely are marked with asterisks.
Now,
do you think that the case of Alejandro versus United States from the Southern District of New York, August 22nd, 2013, gives you a victory on all issues related to this appeal?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, that's the first case that you say you rely on. Obviously, you don't think that the word rely means that it completely resolves the case in your favor.
What I do think that when we're talking about the 2255H2 context, look at whether it relies on, but I also think that you have to rely on in context with the other language in H2, which says the new rule of constitutional law may retroactive by the Supreme Court. It's unclear to me how the Supreme Court can make a rule retroactive that it has not even recognized. We can see that...
Last sentence again, I'm not questioning it. I just didn't quite understand what you said.
So under 2255H2, it says that to get a second, or to file a successive motion, you have to rely on, or 2255, as you used the word contain, a new rule of constitutional law, right? Not just a new rule of constitutional law. It goes on to say made retroactive by the Supreme Court. That was two cases on collateral review that was previously unavailable. My only point is, I think when you read that entire phrase together, not just rely on, but when you read rely on in conjunction with new rule, in conjunction with the clause that says made retroactive by the Supreme Court, it only can mean that the Supreme Court had to already decide the issue that you said that it decided. And it's clear, I think, from Graham that it is not talking about straddling conspiracies. In fact, one salient point on that is I think Judge Kennedy reissued his decision after the then-acting Solicitor General notified him that the statistics that he was relying on about juveniles in the federal prison system was actually not correct, that either those six prisoners were convicted of a homicide, which was not the issue in Graham, or those six petitioners were convicted of a straddling conspiracy, which is what we have here. Rather than sit on his hands and say, well, that's materially indistinguishable, he took the unusual act in amending his order and clarifying that, in fact, federal prisons has no juvenile non-homicide offenders sentenced to life without parole. I think that makes it abundantly clear that straddling conspiracies do not fall under Graham.
You don't think it just makes it abundantly clear that he is mad at the government for misleading him and he wanted to make sure that the footnote reflects the accurate statistics? It doesn't say anything. It doesn't in any way indicate his view about the importance of this. He's just citing the fact that the original statistics they relied on were incorrect, and here's the correct data.
I don't know whether or not he was mad at the government, but I think my
point.
I think my point is that it shows a lot about what the court thought it was deciding. At the end of the day, he either relies on a new rule, and that may be a tricky question in some instances, in some cases. I don't think that's a tricky question here. Graham is a categorical rule. It drew the line at 18 years old.
But it didn't say what happens to an offense begun under 18 to continue ahead.
Right, and that's...
If the petitioner is correct in his interpretation of how the rule applies to a continuing offense, whether it's federal conspiracy or any other kind of continuing offense,
correct,
then the petitioner can prevail on that argument.
But that's not...
If they're correct. I'm not asking to continue ahead.
If they're correct, Your Honor, but that's not the standard that this court grants successive petitions by. This court grants successive petitions by new rules of constitutional law.
What we're talking about here is a new rule in Graham. The argument is over how that rule applies to this case.
It's not one recognized.
They're arguing on the basis of the new rule. You just say they're getting it wrong as to how it applies.
Your Honor, it's not. It's a extension of a new rule that the Supreme Court has recognized. It is not a new rule recognized. I think everyone agrees that it's not. Straddling conspiracies do not. The Supreme Court has not recognized that straddling conspiracies fall underground, and that's the appropriate inquiry here. Again, I think I would go back to the phrase in H2, 225H2, which says new rule of constitutional law made retroactive by the Supreme Court. It is unclear to me how the Supreme Court can make a new rule retroactive that it itself has not decided. And in fact, In Tyler v. King.
It made the rule here. It decided it was retroactive. What we don't know is whether that rule applies to continuing crimes that extend beyond the birthday.
So when Your Honor says it decided that it was retroactive, it decided that Graham categorical rule is retroactive.
Yeah.
Not that, and that, we agree with that, but not that Stranding-Lee conspiracies are retroactive. In fact,
maybe you can litigate that in the district court.
Your Honor, I would urge the court to look at Tyler v. Kane, in which the court, when it laid out its retroactive principles, it said that to be retroactive, you can't have two cases to say that a new constitutional rule recognized by the Supreme Court is retroactive. You can have the one baseline case which says, let's just take this example, that that certain category of sentences are barred for a particular class of defendants. And then we have Graham, so obviously Graham falls in, within that certain category. But what the court, I think, and Tyler said, which is extremely important here, is it says that, but a new rule cannot be retroactive merely because a lower court finds that new rule. The Supreme Court itself has to find that new rule.
That's pretty clear in the text of the statute. Okay. Further questions?
I'm sorry.
No, no problem. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And do you have any more to say? Does she have any more time to say it in?
Just a couple of quick points, Your Honor. First, on the diligence issue, you don't have to have any conflict with Judge Kaczynski because the Huizar case is not, as the government said, about Rule 25. It's about a sort of judicially created state common law rule, a state common law prison mailbox rule. Second, Mr. Perez appeared to concede that Miller creates a new rule about individualized sentencing. He later seemed to say that it didn't because Roper applied that rule in the juvenile context. But, of course, Roper is a categorical case, not a case about individualized sentencing.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When you go back to the district court, you have to show that you're relying on a new rule of constitutional law made retroactive by the Supreme Court. Now, what we do is we decide whether there's been a prima facie showing of that. But when you go back to the district court, you have to show that you're relying. So the word relying comes into play for
you
in the district court.
Well, I think what we'd have to show in the district court is that we're entitled to relief. Our first argument would be that...
No, you have to show you're entitled to relief, of course, to win. But in order to get past the second or successive threshold, don't you have to show that the claim relies on a new rule of constitutional law? Or am I misreading the statute?
Here, you mean?
I mean in the district court.
There's a portion in 2244 that says, you know, the district court again makes the determination. So yes, we would have to show that as well.
Wouldn't say that because you're citing a case, you're therefore relying on it.
No.
When you go back to the district court, you have to show something more than just that you're citing.
That's right. We have to show something more than just a mere citation. Yes. You know, and it's important not to lose track of the point here that, you know, Mr. Williams is really in the heartland of what Graham and Miller were about. He was 15 when he joined the conspiracy. He was acquitted of every single substantive count that the government alleged against him after he was 18 years old. He joined the conspiracy because his older brothers ran it. This court said on direct appeal that, you know, the negative influences on his life were arguably overwhelming. So if the court has no more further questions, we just ask that you grant both motions.
I would take the matter under advisement. Ms. Theodore, you are appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this matter. The court thanks you for your assistance.
Thank you.